preach this morning. A few weeks ago, Jamie actually preached a lesson that sparked a lot of thoughts, and that was his lesson on the second death. And one of the things I think we tend to do as Christians is we're very practical and pragmatic. Our lessons that we preach and teach and the classes that we preach and go through tend to be very practical on the day-to-day how to live as a Christian, how to improve our lives in this life as a Christian. And that's absolutely what we need. But occasionally, there are times where there are things that maybe not as practical that I think are beneficial. And that lesson on the second death, I think, is one of them. And it made me start to think about what's the nature of hell. And we can see in the Bible, especially if you come from an older Christian background, those of us who were raised with the King James Version of the Bible know that the word hell is used frequently, but it's used for at least three different Greek words. And Jamie actually in his class mentioned Tartarus, which is one of those Greek words, which is the place that is the abode of angels who have sinned against God directly. And the nature of hell is something that I think warrants a very deep study. But before you get to the nature of hell, I think we need to understand the nature of God himself, and specifically the presence of God. And we see the presence of God infrequently in the Bible. It's in the Old Testament, there are a very few specific instances that we're going to cover this morning that talk about the presence of God. In the New Testament, the presence of God is changed and different. But the reason why this is important is because ultimately we will find ourselves in the presence of God. And the presence of God is going to be overwhelming to us. And I don't think, as we talk about the scriptures we're going to go through, we're going to see that so much of what God describes to us about him and his presence is sort of like if we were to go out and try to describe to an ant on the ground what our life was like. It would be impossible because there is such a difference between us and that ant. I guess we're in South Florida. We should say a palmetto bug. Probably be easier to find. But it's too hard for us to understand the nature of God because God is outside creation. He is not beholden to the limits of this creation. And so when he presents himself to us, and the examples we're going to read about, there's no way for us as humans to fully understand the true presence of God. And until we are in that spiritual realm where we're facing the presence of God directly, I don't think we're ever truly going to understand it. But today I want to go through some instances of the presence of God that we find in the Bible and see what we learn about them, and ultimately, as we close our lesson today, take something away from this that we can make practical in our lives about the presence of God. We're going to start in the Old Testament. We'll go to 1 Kings chapter 8. So if we remember from our Old Testament studies, David was the king who was a man after God's own heart, and he wanted to build the temple of God. And because he was a man of war, God told him he couldn't. And he said, your son Solomon is going to be the one who's going to build the temple of God. And then Solomon comes into power, and he builds the temple of God. And it's an incredible structure for its time. And then came the point at which they are going to, essentially we would say now, consecrate the temple. And they do this by bringing the Ark of the Covenant. And if we remember from again, back in the book of Exodus, the ark is that figurehead of God amongst the Israelites. It's the ark in which God puts his presence when he was amongst them. And in chapter 8 of 1 Kings, verse 1, "Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the father's household of the sons of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant from the city of David, which is Zion. All the men of Israel assembled themselves to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethiam, which is the seventh month. Then all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled to him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priests brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place into the inner sanctum of the house, to the most holy place under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim made a covering over the ark and its poles from above. But the poles were so long that the ends could not be seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside. They are there to this day. And there was nothing in the ark except for the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, which the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel. And when they came out of the land of Egypt, and it happened that when the priests came from the holy place, the cloud filled the house of the Lord." And so we see here, this cloud represents the presence of God. And I don't want to say his physical presence, because we know God is not physical. He is spiritual. But when God manifests his presence in person, we see in the Old Testament several instances. Cloud is usually, as we've seen, and you see there at the end of verse 11, "The cloud was so thick that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord." So this cloud, we see here in the writer of the book of Kings, that this cloud was not just thick. It's not a thick fog. It also seemed to glow, and it prevented these priests from doing their jobs, because God himself was here in the temple. He was there amongst the people. And if we want to see another example, the same instance in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, we see there that 2 Chronicles 7. Verse 1 says, "Now when Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offerings and the sacrifice. And the glory of the Lord filled the house. And the priests could not enter into the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled the Lord's house. All the sons of Israel, seeing the fire come down and the glory of the Lord upon the house, bowed down to the pavement with their faces to the ground, and they worshipped and gave praise to the Lord, saying, 'Truly he is good, truly his loving kindness is everlasting.'" So we see here, not only is there a cloud that fills the glory of the Lord into the temple, but also there's fire that came down indicating the power of God. And that's the thing that we have to understand, is God's presence is beyond anything that we can think of. And when we sit here and try to think about what God is truly like, what is his nature, what is his presence like, it's not something that we really have the ability to describe. And every time we see in the Old Testament an instance of the presence of God described, it's generally we see clouds involved. You remember before the tabernacle of the Lord that the Israelites followed through the 40 years of wandering, during the daytime it was a pillar of clouds, and at night it was a pillar of fire. These clouds and fire always indicate the presence of God and this overwhelming presence that he had amongst them. And the thing is, clouds, you know, have you ever driven? I know I'm from Mississippi, right? Most all of you know this, but occasionally I have had the opportunity to drive through the Smoky Mountains. And if you've ever driven through the Smoky Mountains early in the morning or late at night, there's often, you know, this fog comes in. And that's why they're called the Smokies, because you get this fog condensation. And it's quite difficult to drive, and sometimes you just don't even take a chance and you get off the road. This kind of thing, it's mysterious. It hides the true nature of what's behind it. And that's the same thing with this presence of God. And why he uses clouds so often when we're talking about his presence is because we can't really understand the true nature of God. We also know from what God and Moses had a discussion on Mount Horeb that we as humans are not really capable of seeing the true presence of God, are we? Moses asked if he could see God face to face, and the answer was no, because no human can handle seeing my true glory. So the cloud and the fire that is described here in the sanctification of the temple is, again, the same thing that we see with Moses, that humans can't handle the true glory of God. So two things that are very powerful and mysterious, this controlled cloud and this fire, represents God's power and his control over everything on the earth. If you go to Ezekiel 43, in verse 10 of 43, Ezekiel's given a vision of the glory of God coming back into the temple after Ezekiel had been ordered to rebuild the temple. And I know we're going through a lot of Old Testament verses, and we're not kind of used to jumping from book to book in the Old Testament. But in verse 10 of 43, it says, "As for you, son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. If they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the house and its structure, its exits, its entrance, all its designs, all its statutes, and all its laws, and write it in their sight so that they may observe the whole design and all of its statutes and do them. This is the law of the house. The entire area on top of the mountain all around shall be holy. Behold, this is the law of the house." So this temple of God that is on the temple mount, where we were just seeing described, the Babylonians destroyed it, and Ezekiel's being told to rebuild it. And to remind him, what's the big reminder at the end of this, is that this is the place where God interacts with man, and therefore the entire Temple Mount should be considered holy. And the reason why is because this is where the presence of God interacts with man. And we see again back in Exodus, if you go to Exodus 19, the presence of God as it interacts with man is just more than what man can handle. Chapter 19, at verse 10, "The Lord also said to Moses, 'Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people.'" So he's telling them that they're going to consecrate the people to God at this place. And he's warning them that his presence is going to be there on Mount Sinai as they worship God below. And in verse 18, if you skip down there, "Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down, warn the people so that they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish.' and also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it. Then the Lord said to him, go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them. So we see the presence of God, again, this powerful presence of the clouds. In fact, Mount Sinai is said to be like a furnace, smoking and quaking, and the voice was like thunder, and we see fire, and this had to be terrifying for the people of Israel at this point, to be in the presence of God, to see his power over all things, and to know that they really are powerless against God. And that's ultimately the lesson that we need to take from the presence of God. What is the lesson? What is the practical lesson that we have from this theological discussion of the presence of God? Well, the practical lesson is that we are powerless in front of God, and that ultimately we are going to stand in front of the presence of God on Judgment Day. And when we do that, when we stand in front of his presence, that we are going to know what true power is. All of these things that we see happening on earth, all these political things, all these wars and other things that happen around the globe are trivial. They don't matter, because when we face God, it's going to be each of us individually facing him, each of us in front of the presence of God. And when we are in front of the presence of God, what the decision comes from that meeting is going to ultimately decide the rest of eternity for us. And that's why understanding the presence of God matters so much, because when we stand in front of the presence of God, there is not going to be a single person who ever lived who is ever going to be able to deny that God exists. There will be no atheists on the day of judgment. And we will be filled with the glory of God. There won't be clouds in front of us hiding his glory from us. We are going to face him face to face. And how terrible is that going to be, to face the true glory of God, to see him in all of his awesome nature, and then be told to go into everlasting torment. We can see in the New Testament, Jesus has taken up and is this presence. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 24. Says, but Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for us. You know, the one thing that we need to remember, that's chapter 7, and then chapter 9. My iPad is just jumping all over verses. It's not going where I'm telling it to. In chapter 9 at verse 24, it says, for Christ did not enter the holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, so now to appear in the presence of God for us. So we see Solomon back in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles, as they brought the ark into the inner chamber of the holies of holy in the temple, and God's presence was there. But Jesus, after he rose from the dead and went into heaven, is in the presence of God himself specifically for us, specifically to make intercession for us. And as we see back in chapter 7 that we read earlier, that he is there to grant us the ability to enter into the presence of God without fear. And that's what Jesus came here to do, is he is to bring us into the presence of God without fear, and into the loving kindness of God. Jude, I know we read this recently in Jamie's class, Jude 24, "Now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to make you stand in the presence of his glory, blameless with great joy." We, as Christians, if we're obedient to God, are going to be able to stand in the presence of God, not because we deserve it more than Moses did, but because Jesus granted us this ability to stand before God because he blessed us through his death, burial, and resurrection on the cross. That we now have the hope of eternal life because of Jesus and what he did, and that grants us the ability to be in the presence of God. If we're not found in the presence of God, what is that going to mean? Well, all of us, we're all Christians, we understand that means hell. We know that means eternal life. We see in the book of Revelation in chapter 6, John writing those who at the final judgment realize that they're not going to be found in favor with God. Verse 16 of chapter 6, it says, "And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for great is the day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" If we're not found in favor with God, we're not going to be able to stand before him. We're going to be wishing every other punishment on the face of the earth but to stand in front of the glory of God, because we know that after that we're going to be taken away into eternal punishment. And then chapter 20 of Revelation, we see ultimately in verse 11 this scenario I was talking about, where we are find ourselves in the presence of God for the final judgment. Verse 11, "Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were open, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books, according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades were given up dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire." Again, I think when we are reading about hell and this lake of fire, it's beyond our comprehension to really understand what hell, eternal damnation, is going to be like. And fire is one of these things that we understand even today. If you were to burn yourself in a fire severely, it's not something that's easily healed. You know, as far as modern medicine has advanced, getting burned really badly is not something that is easy to solve for medicine. So we see and understand the power of fire. And this power of fire is going to be from not being in the presence of God any longer, from being completely separated from him for eternity. But the final reason why this is important is in the next chapter, in 21. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, come down out of the heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away.'" And finally, in verse 5, "And he who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.'" Heaven is going to be nothing but us in the presence of God. And I don't think we can truly sit here today and say we understand what that means. And I think that's why so many depictions of heaven and hell are given the way they are given because we just don't fully have a concept for what the presence of God is. He filled the temple up with the cloud, and the fire burned all of the burnt offerings, completely destroyed them. I mean, and remember from our reading in 1 Kings, there were so many they couldn't count them, all these burnt offerings they had. You know, his voice to the people was like thunder in Exodus. The presence of God exceeds anything that we can ever think of. And the practical part of this lesson is we should leave here today understanding that we don't want to be anywhere but the presence of God. That's going to mean a couple of things. That's going to mean there might be some people here today that are not Christians who really haven't given much thought to this, because usually when we're talking about church, we're talking about the moralistic things of this life that we should and shouldn't do. But ultimately, heaven and our desire for eternal life is about being with God and being in his presence for eternity. So if you're not a Christian, don't miss the opportunity to make your life right so that you can be in his eternal presence, so that you can know God as God really is without cloud and fire in your way. If you are a Christian and there's something in your life that you would like to correct, some sin that you've committed or some other thing that you need the prayers of the congregation from, this is an opportunity that you can make your life right. Strengthen yourself through the prayers of this group. Whatever your need is, we ask that you come forward now as we stand and as we sing.